Terrific. Then I'll call the case of Benjamin Dubay versus Stephen King. Is Mr. Cook?
Yes,
with us?
Yes, this is Mr. Cook.
All right, we're ready to hear from you.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel, on behalf of Mr. Dubay and myself, I'd like to thank the court and administrative staff for assisting in the technological challenges to presenting this virtual argument.
We give them a lot of practice. that we think they're terrific. So thank you for thanking them.
Yes, thank you. If any time someone can't hear me, please let me know. The Rook. The man who time forgot, aka Reston Dane, is the character created by Bud Lewis and Bill Dubay at the Cartoon Factory in 1976. This is the character for which my client, Ben Dubay, requests this court's protection from copyright infringement. For the purposes of this appeal, it is uncontested that Mr. Dubay holds a valid copyright for Reston Dane. And construing all inferences in my client's favor, Mr. King had access to the Rook. Although notably, Mr. King denied reviewing Warren comics in the mid to late 70s until at his deposition, we showed him a copy of a book that he wrote, Dance Macabre, where he actually cites to and writes about the success of Warren comics, who was the publisher of Erie, where the Rook first appeared. Approximately 8 million copies of The Rook appeared in approximately 8 million copies of comics from January 1977 through 1983. The issue before this court is whether or not Mr. King's character, Roland Deschaine, is substantially similar in quantity or quality to our character, Reston Dane.
Now, the district court. Well, he's certainly similar in quantity, right? He one to one. So what do you mean by quantity?
Well, in quantity would be simply the number of similarities, as opposed to quality, which would be the...
Got it.
Mr. Cook, you say that Stephen King had access to the Rook comic book series, but let me just push back on that a little bit, because Stephen King has said he stopped reading Erie before 1977. He never had access to the Rook comic book series. You've pointed out that he admitted to having acquired a copy of either Erie or Creepy on one occasion in 78, but what evidence is there that that copy contained a story from the Rook series?
Well, Your Honor, in addition to the widely disseminated argument that we maintain as far as access, in his book, Dance Macabre, he actually wrote not an entire chapter, but a good section of the chapter about the black and white comics of the time. In addition to that, he was actually teaching a class at the University of Maine on similar topics. So we feel that access, there is certainly sufficient evidence of access, which was not, there was no finding of no access in the district court opinion. The district court decided this case solely on substantial similarity. If I may proceed, Your Honor. Thank you.
Please.
In comparing substantial similarity, there is a Ninth Circuit case, which I realize isn't binding, but it is useful, I think, for this court's consideration, and that's the DC Comics v. Cowell case, the Batmobile case. And when considering substantial similarity in regards to characters, there are three factors that they laid out that I think are useful. First, the character must generally have physical as well as conceptual qualities. Second, the character must be sufficiently delineated to be recognizable as the same character wherever it appears, or he appears, or she appears. And third, the character must be especially distinctive and contain some unique elements of expression. Notably, the main error that the district court made in this case, in Judge Schlesinger's own opinion, is that the district court never made an analysis of whether or not rest and deign was sufficiently delineated, which should have been the first step, because if the district court doesn't consider what is sufficiently delineated, there's no data points to say, okay, this is what is going to be compared to the alleged infringing work. And since the district court never made that initial determination, as in her own opinion, page 29 in the footnote, the rest of the process was doomed to fail in the analysis of the comparison of these two characters. Now, the appellee's experts do concede in certain circumstances that rest and deign alone may be protectable by copyright law, but they maintain that Roland is not substantially similar in protectable expression to Reston, because these few features that are distinctively delineated in Reston are not part of Roland. An abstraction of the sufficiently delineated elements at the heart of the character of Reston Dane, which the district court did not engage in, but if this court does engage in, will reveal the Rest and Deign has a name certain and an alias, Rest and Deign, AKA the Rook. He has a distinctive home, a towering castle, Rook Castle. This is one manner in which his knightly feel is expressed. He dresses like a gunslinger, reminiscent of old Westerns, but he is not a gunslinger. He is actually a diplomat, like his father before him. At one point, he takes the personality of his black bird of prey, the Rook, which is not like a crow, as indicated in some of the documents. A rook is much different than a crow. But he takes the personality of his black bird of prey, and in his introductory story, his black bird of prey actually goes into battle with him. He is a time traveler. And this type of time travel, the space-time continuum, is expressed as being controlled from the castle tower, which he consistently is trying to return to, often is prevented from getting to, and never allowed to remain at.
Mr. Cook, can I ask you a question? Sort of before we get too far down the line, I mean, at their core, at their essence, though, aren't your character and Mr. King's character pretty different? I mean, your character, you say, he's not really a gunslinger, he's a diplomat. It seems to me like he's fundamentally a good guy. Mr. King's character does some really raunchy stuff, sexual assault with a gun, it just seems to me at their essence, they're pretty different people.
Well, the initial character in, so the original Gunslinger novel was comprised of five chapters. In the first chapter, which was also titled The Gunslinger, Roland Deschain, Mr. King's character, is significantly different from Reston Deign. But what happens is, once chapter two is written and comes out, there's a drastic change, and this is even acknowledged by Robin Firth. There's a drastic change in Roland Deschain. So you can't really compare, let me put it like this. If it was just chapter one, this case would not be here, because Roland Deschain was a different character. Roland Deschain was not a time traveler in chapter one. It's in chapter two, starting in the way station, where you see the transformation. That is where the infringement occurs, because it is the transformation of Roland that occurs in chapter two that infringes upon the specifically delineated and expressed ideas and traits of Reston Deign. So I think you have to look at the before and after. And if you compare the original chapter, I would agree with you, but that's not what we're comparing. That's not what we're alleging. May I proceed?
You may. Please.
Thank you. So one of the cases that is a leading case for the 11th Circuit is the Lay v. Warner Brothers case, which I'm confident the court is familiar with. In that case, it was the picture of the bird girl, and the bird girl was extracted. And in that case, the court did in fact go through the abstraction process to say, what are the unique elements of this piece of art or this photograph that may warrant protection? And in that case, the court found that it was the positioning of the statue in the middle of the picture. It was the angle, the lighting, that the picture was taken from a low angle. Well, lighting, angle, the position, these are all ideas. But in Lay v. Warner Brothers, these ideas combined into a unique expression of this photograph, of this statue. The statue was in the public domain. The same concept applies here. The district court gets, and I did provide some exhibits. I don't think we have time to get to them, but if you look at the exhibits that I provided, the charts, the court, the district court made the assessment of this case at the lower levels. In other words, they broke it down to the ideas and said, well, these are all just ideas and therefore there's no infringement. When really the proper analysis is to start at the top. What is the sufficiently delineated expression of this character? And you do that by comparing what are his expressions. And so the analysis should go from the top down on the charts that I provided to the court and counsel. Recently in the CompuLife case, this court held that protectability consists of the absence of proving unprotectability. Appellees have provided no prior art or character with the same combination of unique traits as Rest and Dane. Now, at the district court level, the reason that you have to first isolate what is the protectable expression is because if you don't do that, which the district court states they did not do, then you don't know what, it doesn't even give defendants an opportunity to say what prior art they should be looking for, because once the plaintiff or the person seeking protection says, hey, here is our protectable expression, it's these elements combined in this unique way, then the defendant doesn't have to produce the entirety of history. They have to say, okay, here's prior art. You say these are the unique things, the unique way they're combined. At that point, the defendant can go show prior art. They have not done that in this case because none exist. Roland is the second comer. The black bird of prey is a very unique thing combined with a time traveler. Even defendant's expert, Bob Gale, admitted this. But yet, the district court broke this down and said, well, the district court actually admitted the birds are similar, the characters look similar. Arizona or the Old West is basically mid-world, unfortunately I'm out of time.
Well, you saved some time for rebuttal, so we'll hear from you again.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Is Vincent Cox with us?
Yes, can you hear me?
I can.
Yep. Your Honors, my name is Vincent Cox, and I represent six defendants. The author, Stephen King, and his publisher, Simon & Schuster, Marvel Entertainment, which published the graphic novels that were based upon the Dark Tower saga, and then three defendants who were involved in the production and distribution of a theatrical motion picture called The Dark Tower, based upon the book. Today, what
your client Marvel does a lot of filming around our courthouse, so we know them.
Well,
for better or for worse.
Well, the crucial flaw in the plaintiff's analysis is the emphasis upon protectability in a way that turns it into a red herring. Protectability of graphic characters is, in a way, a much simpler analysis than fictional characters. Graphic characters can be protected simply on the basis of as paintings, in effect. What we're dealing with here are characters that are built up as fictional characters over a period of time and with an accumulation of characteristics that, in order to be protectable, need to be distinctively delineated. Now, we do have a great deal of delineation of Roland Deschain over the course of 32 years in which Stephen King wrote these seven novels and a novella. You need, though, not to divorce protectability from the infringement analysis. When you turn to infringement, you look at the elements that are were distinctively delineated as the ones that could be infringed. To take an example, if you had James Bond and you look at whether or not he's distinctively delineated, the things that distinctively delineate him are his Aston Martin, his particular weapon, his license to kill, his debonair good looks. The things that delineate him are the things that are protectable. You don't consider, oh, he's protectable, and now let's look at similarities to some other detective or some other secret agent, be it George Smiley or Matt Helm or whatever other character you might have.
And Mr. Cox, I've over the years, I've come to think about these things in terms of somebody's got to write this. And I just had a question for how you would answer this question to make sure it's that I'm understanding it correctly. So can you just tell me what parts of Roland's character Mr. King had created by 1977?
Yes. Roland Deschain was someone who was on a quest for the tower. He was somebody who was chasing the black. There was a man in black that he, the first sentence of the first book is the man in black fled across the desert and the gunslinger pursued him. That in fact is the last sentence of the last book. The notion of him as a having tremendous skills as a gunslinger, the fact that he has used a bird to win his contest with his instructor that he needed to in order to become a gunslinger. There were, I know in the brief we've listed quite a few of those things, and so they're basically the character as a man in the throes of a quest that he can't control were all there, and all of those elements were there. His tortured self, all of those things were there from the outset. And what we had here in this case was the problem of presenting to the court the totality of the character and the character's development. So essentially all of the elements that are in the first book and that are in Robin Firth's summation of the character arc in the first book, those character elements were created before 1977. They're contained in the University of Maine Folger Library manuscript that was typed by Denise Kelly. And we had her deposition, and she was able to produce a letter from Mr. King acknowledging her work. It's very clear that Stephen King had created Roland before the time came when The Rook was ever published. The only thing I would footnote is that the name Deschain was never given to the character until 1997 in the fourth book. And then later when he came to revise the initial book in 2003, he put the name back into it. So just a footnote there. In any case, the analysis of character similarity has to look at the elements of the character that are distinctly developed. And here, the things that they're pointing to are the most banal elements of the characters, and even there, they're playing word games about what things are similar. For instance, the insistence that Roland is a time traveler. Well, when you read the books, as I have, what Roland is doing is he's going between parallel universes that are not synchronized in time. He doesn't have a time machine as the Rook does, where the Rook will decide to go back to a particular event in time, say the Alamo, and then just direct the machine there. Roland does not understand how it works, the travel between these non-synchronized universes is magical. He finds this magical door on a beach and goes through it and is suddenly transported into an airliner in 1989. It's just never really explained how he does that, and Roland doesn't understand it. Plaintiff insists that Roland is a future man. Well, the nature of non-synchronized universes is that you can't even talk about what's future and what's past. They're just entirely different types of characters. And the other aspect of this that I wanted to bring out, because it's hard to sometimes to see this, the nature of Stephen King's creative process is that the story creates the character. The story is the boss. He creates a character and the character does things. And in a way, the story determines who the character is. In fact, oddly enough, in volume six of the books, Stephen King, a fictional Stephen King, encounters Roland Deschain and talks with him about the creative process and talks about how, I wanted to make you Clint Eastwood, but after what you did in Tull, I couldn't do it anymore. You weren't going to be a fun guy to deal with. And so King creates these things out of the events. The whole notion that somehow you could use that kind of a creative process to lift something from this series of comic books is just preposterous. Judge Schlesinger did an extraordinarily good job of synthesizing a tremendous amount of information and distilling plaintiff's contentions as to the similar elements. And that's what his opinion does. The opinion deals with each of plaintiff's contentions and does a very good job of judiciously setting forth the best parts of plaintiff's argument and seriatim dismissing their significance, because they aren't significant. There is really, character protection is something that needs to be neither overprotective nor underprotective. My clients all have an interest in character protection. We are not saying that characters are not protectable. What we are saying is distinctively delineated characters are protected, and the things that are protected are the things that make them distinctive, not just, oh, now you're protected and now we look at the totality. No, you have to look at the specific element that makes that character who he or she is. And that has to be the way that these kind of analyses are performed. Are there any particular questions that the panel has for me? Because I would, I don't want to wander about.
You've answered the particular question I had, Mr. Cox. I don't know about my colleagues.
Well, I wanted to mention the element in this case of our using summaries, because I think that was, for me as a copyright lawyer, I've never done that before. And I think that it was necessary here, because no court could be expected to read this 4,000 page series of books. And so we needed to hire somebody to prepare a reliable summary. And the court took it into evidence and read it without objection from the other side. And the report that was prepared by our expert, Bob Gale, does an excellent job of really parsing what parts of the plaintiff's character are potentially protectable, and also what parts of Roland Deschain are protectable as well. So if there are no further questions, thank you, Your Honor. The decision of the district court should be affirmed.
Thank you, Mr. Cox. Mr. Cook.
Thank you. Briefly to address some of the issues raised by Mr. Cox, he is now arguing independent creation, which is not the issue that's before this court. Independent creation is hotly contested. He mentioned that Denise Kelly allegedly typed this manuscript in 1975 at the University of Maine. Well, Stephanie Leonard, who is Stephen King's sister-in-law, testified that she couldn't have done that. So these are all factual disputes. Independent creation is a hotly contested factual dispute. The district court didn't even address it as far as a grounds for summary judgment. So, you know, if that's something that, you know, we address at a later hearing when we are back in front of the district court, we can certainly do that. In regards to the summary of Robin Firth, we do and always have contested the summary and the accuracy of the summary. Not the idea, we didn't object to the idea of using a summary because of the volume of the works, but rather her summary. As we've detailed in our briefs.
Mr. You can actually help me with that, Mr. Cook. I mean, do you challenge Ms. Firth's methodology?
Absolutely. In fact, Ms. Firth challenges her own methodology because Ms. Firth states that a close reading, which is the methodology in her purported field of expertise, requires an unbiased review of the facts. So if her methodology requires an unbiased review, but yet her entire professional career is primarily premised upon her work for Stephen King, her work on the Marvel, call them comics, but the illustrated graphic novels, I guess they're called these days. Her entire career is premised upon Stephen King's
work. Well, it sounds like you're not, I mean, to me, that sounds like you're saying no matter what her methodology was, she couldn't have engaged it because she was biased in favor of Mr. King, which is not really a challenge to her methodology, the way I look at it.
No, I think if her methodology was something different, we would be in a different scenario. But Robin Firth is the one that told us what the accepted methodology was. Robin Firth said it requires an unbiased review. So I'm not the one that selected the methodology. I don't contest that that is the accurate methodology, but the reality is that she did not. I mean, she omitted things from her report. For example, she omitted that Earth is with a capital E. It's Earth is Earth. And I'm out of time, so
All right, thank you very much. It's an interesting case and we got it. We've taken it under advisement.